Okay, it's 10 o'clock, so let's start our issue-specific hearing this morning. And welcome, everyone. Some of you were here yesterday, but a lot of you weren't. So my name is Frances Fernandez, and I have been appointed as a lead member of this panel of inspectors by the Secretary of State for the Ministry of Housing, Communities and Local Government. And with me today are my colleagues Menaka Sahai, Peter Braithwaite, Stephen Bradley, and Annie Coombs, and we are the panel of five appointed inspectors to examine and report on this application made by Norfolk Boreas Limited for an order granting development consent for the Norfolk Boreas offshore wind farm project. Now, it's a beautiful room. It's got incredibly high ceilings, so there is an echo. So what I would really ask you all to do is be really diligent about your use of the microphone and really speak closely to it, because otherwise the audio just doesn't pick up the sound too well. And I'll remind you during the day, but if you could really just remember to speak quite closely into the microphone, that would be really helpful, okay? And can everybody hear at the back of the room? Because again, we had a few problems yesterday with the voices traveling. All right, and I'm sure you'll let me know if people can't be heard. So you're all very welcome today. You'll also have met the case team as you came in. They're very helpful. If you haven't already introduced yourself, please do. And they are your kind of point of contact as we continue through this examination. There are no planned fire alarms, so if the fire alarm does go off, then please get out of the building, and you can see the green signs around the room. I'm not anticipating any journalists here, unless anybody's going to indicate otherwise, nor indeed request to use social media. Nope. Okay, so then let's press on, and I'm going to ask you all to introduce yourselves, but as I said yesterday, although I appreciate many of you weren't here, please speak slowly when you introduce yourself so that we have a time to write down who you are and the organisation you represent. And I'm going to begin on the left, please.
Good morning. My name is John Houghton, and I spell my name H-O-U-G-H-T-O-N, from Womble Bond Dickinson, representing the applicant. We have handed in a list of appearances for today. I'll ask our front bench to introduce themselves now, and on one or two occasions later on, I may want to introduce other members joining the front bench, explaining why they're there and where they come from. Thank you.
Good morning, Victoria Redman, a partner from Womble Bond Dickinson, on behalf of the applicant.
Good morning, Jake Laws, Consents Manager for Norfolk Boreas, on behalf of the applicant.
Hello, Dave Tarrant, EIA Coordinator Offshore, on behalf of the applicant.
Victoria Cooper, Marine Heritage Consultant for Royal Haskoning DHV, on behalf of the applicant.
Good morning. Christopher Pater, Head of Marine Planning with Historic England.
Lise Quinn, Marine Science Officer for the Eastern Inshore Fisheries and Conservation Authority.
Good morning, Nick Salter from the Maritime and Coast Guard Agency.
Good morning, Rebecca Reid from the Marine Management Organisation Case Officer.
Good morning, Ellie Noble, Case Manager from the MMO.
I'm sorry, could you repeat your name? I didn't catch it.
Sorry, Ellie Noble.
Ellie Noble.
Good morning, I'm Chris McMullen from Natural England, a Principal Advisor for Marine Development. If I could introduce my colleagues here with me today. We also might need to exchange a few people as we go through the agenda, if that's okay, and I can happily introduce them when we get to that point. So on my right, we've got Alan Gibson, and he's our Senior Responsible Officer for the Boreas case. Next to him is Matthew Boyer, B-O-Y-E-R, and he's our Solicitor for Natural England. And also Louise Burton, who's our benthic specialist for this case today. Thank you.
Thank you very much for those introductions. I'm going to hand over now to Mr. Braithwaite, who will lead us through the hearing today. Thank you.
Well, thank you very much, and good morning, everyone. We will be following the agenda today, and hopefully it's not as demanding an agenda as yesterday, and we will get through everything. To begin with, I'd like to move to item 3. Which is the archaeological written scheme of investigation. And this part of the agenda will be led by Mr. Bradley.
Thank you. Despite the confidence about the agenda, I think we really need to try to get through this first part as quickly as we can. So what I'd like to do is to focus in this agenda item on the landfall site. In relation to the installation of cables under the intertidal zone. Firstly, I'd like to understand the applicant's thinking about the procedures and sensitivities for post-consent survey of this area of seabed, just seaward of the low water line, especially in regard to identified potential for archaeological assets to be found and at different depths below the seabed. So I don't know whether you have any exhibits that you'd like to put on screen, but if you could just talk us through the process, and we'll then pass over to Mr. Pate to see if he has any questions.
So the approach to archaeological investigation.
Could
survey.
We just ask you to introduce yourself when you speak? Just always,
sorry.
All our hearings are recorded, and when we're listening to them at some other date or other people are listening, then it makes it clear who's speaking.
Yeah, Victoria Cooper, Royal Haskoning DHV. So the approach to survey and investigation for archaeological purposes offshore is done sort of coherently as part of a overarching approach to archaeology. So archaeological advice is sought in planning or post-consent geophysical geotechnical surveys, and also in project-led ROV and diver surveys looking at ground truthing and investigation, for example, associated with UXO investigations or boulder clearance. I did want to note, having brought that up, that UXO and boulder clearance aren't being licensed. The license is not being applied for as part of this application. They will be subject to a separate marine license application post-consent, but the measures set out in the written scheme of investigation, which I'll come to in a bit, look to cover these activities as well, so that there is an overarching coherent approach to addressing archaeology, should consent be granted. So if required, further investigation, mitigation would be considered on a case-by-case basis, looking at specific sites, specific areas.
Can I cut you short?
Yeah.
Because you're very helpfully talking through the generality, which, of course, is well set out. I want to focus on this particular patch of seabed where there will be construction activities to bring the cables onshore.
So in terms of the HDD at the landfall, obviously with the HDD option, you're not going to be causing impacts to archaeology above where the tunnelling takes place.
I'm sorry, the point at which the entry of the cables.
The entry of the cables.
Yes, exactly.
Okay, so at the entry of the cables, there would be excavation of an exit entry pit to take the cables through into the HDD. That would be, first of all, covered by geophysical survey. So we'd have an understanding through the techniques applied what was present or what had archaeological potential on the surface, but also using techniques such as sub-bottom profiling or magnetometer data. We have a better understanding of what could be buried in that area as well. So that would be the first step, to use remote survey to be able to understand better what is specifically within the footprint of that excavation. There will also be geotechnical survey. I don't know the scope of that, obviously, at the moment, how that would be, but to improve that understanding of the subsurface deposits in that area so that we can be certain that any archaeological potential in that area can be addressed before any construction works take place.
Thank you. What do you see the risks and opportunities being here? And I'm not just addressing this to the archaeological team, but actually to the overall interfacing of activity here, because clearly the selection, the micro-siting, if you like, of where the pits will be located is of crucial importance here. I'd like you to help me to understand a little bit more of the characterization of this zone of search.
So I think it's important to raise the fact that where we are at the landfill is in the area of perhaps the most significant Paleolithic site that we've found archaeologically in recent times. And we don't currently understand from an archaeological perspective the relationship between the Cromophorus bed offshore and how that onshore and how that extends into the near shore zone. It seems to be absent, but there's a lot of sort of unanswered questions in this zone archaeologically. So this work here actually presents a real opportunity to be able to get information to inform that. To an extent as well that we've already started speaking with key individuals at the British Museum and University of Southampton to make sure that they know what we're doing and also so that they have an engagement in that process as well. Mm-hmm. So that's really the key kind of area from an archaeological perspective at this nearshore point, is finding out that information. So that actually presents a real opportunity to get information. In terms of risk, from an archaeological perspective, it's very rare that in the marine environment we would find an in-situ archaeological site. I'm sure they're there, but the techniques available to us make it difficult to locate these sites. If we were to locate one, the opportunity to investigate would be wonderful. So from my point of view, I think that's what I would say on risk as an opportunity from an archaeological perspective.
Switching focus a little bit then to, does this have a mutual bearing on the selection of cable duct installation method? One of the things that I would just refer back to yesterday's discussion, clearly that's very much a matter for post-consent review. Mr. Driver behind you, I think, might be ready to answer on this one.
Yes.
Rob Driver on behalf of the applicant. Yes, I think, just to add a little bit to what Vic said a moment ago, as you know, we're proposing drill out to beyond the 6 meter depth contour as a minimum. So the intertidal zone will be will at surface level will not be affected by the drilling operation. And I think in terms of the splay that we have within the red line boundary, that gives us a reasonable amount of scope to microsite the locations of the breakout points from each of the drills. So if there is information available from surveys that suggests particular areas should be avoided, then there will be some ability to accommodate that. In terms of the method that is selected for the drill itself, the intention is that the drills will be quite a long way below the beach platform, probably of the order of 10 meters below that, in order to select an appropriate stratum of material for the drilling process. And I think and also to ensure that there is resilience of that installation against future erosion, ongoing erosion processes, because as we all know, the coastline in this area is a movable feast. That's the primary consideration. In terms of the drilling technology itself, I think at the moment the jury is still out on which technology is going to deliver the least risk, both in terms of success of achieving the required drill and least risk of impacts in terms of breakouts or other undesirable effects that could affect the intertidal zone. So I think we need to clearly carry out a detailed evaluation of those different technologies with respect to the kinds of impacts that I think you're referring to that we all wish to avoid.
Thank you. I mean, clearly the potential impacts are multiple. In this case, I think just to perhaps give an opportunity for Historic England to make a comment, let's focus on the potential differential impact of different methods and whether the archaeological considerations have or should have a substantial bearing on your choice of method. I think before putting you on the spot on that, Mr. Driver, can I just ask Mr. Pater if he'd like to come in here?
Thank you. Christopher Pater from Historic England. I think one of the points which is worth considering, particularly with the referral to horizontal directional drilling techniques, the HDD techniques, which was subject to discussion between us during the pre-application phase of this proposed project, which was the depth at which it would be going under the foreshore. Mr. Driver has just alluded to a depth of HDD of 10 meters below the, presumably that's below the exposed sort of intertidal beach platform. So the point that Victoria Cooper was making regarding the presence of sedimentary sequences of particular archaeological interest, dare I say importance, is the relative depth of that to where the HDD should be occurring. And I am confident in terms of the information that was presented to us during the pre-application phase of this and as part of the DCO application to explain, well, from our analysis, from the applicant's analysis and understanding of the sedimentary sequences on the foreshore, should HDD be adopted as the preferred technique, then it shouldn't lead to direct disturbance or destruction of those sedimentary sequences. Yeah. It should be deeper, hopefully, than those sequences. But this has been a topic that was discussed in detail between us.
Good. Any other comments or observations before passing back to Mr. Driver?
Nothing further at this point. Thank you.
Mr. Driver.
The only point I'd like to add is that obviously if there is, we will take account of where the chromophorus bed layer is, where that is known with certainty, and ensure that the drilling level is not at that same level.
Thank you. Now, this is all covered in, if you like, in a theoretical basis in the outline WSI. Are we confident that we have the security that's needed to give flexibility of method in relation to the archaeological WSI? Is there back again to this point about differential impact, is one method which you will choose post-consent going to be more or less impactful as it emerges? I think differentiating the horizontal below the beach platform and where the impact arises at the emergence that's below the 6 meter contour. It may be simple, but I have no idea about the technology here.
Yes. I'm not a drilling specialist. But my understanding is that we're not talking about different techniques that have fundamentally different impacts here.
Okay. Thank you.
We're talking about differences of technique to achieve the same design of catenary coming down from the fields behind the beach, below the beach, and emerging at roughly the same location. So the objective is the same: is to achieve an annulus into which you can pull a set of ducts, and then into those ducts you can install a cable. That's really the engineering output from all of this, and the question is how you establish that annulus in the first place.
Very good, thank you. I think that's fine. You'll be submitted. I rather hope that this will now be written up and submitted post hearing, so that covers that nicely. Moving on, is there anything further?
The notes will be written up anyway.
Yeah.
Just on a small matter of housekeeping, I noticed, Mr. Driver, that you don't appear on the list of appearances. So perhaps that could just be added. And I'm not sure about yesterday's, but it just doesn't seem to be on my list at any rate.
I hope you've got his details as a result of yesterday's list of appearances, but yes, noted, we'll add it.
Now, I think the... we'll move on now to Roman numeral 2. Could we have app 022 up on screen? Now, this is in regard to the relationship of plans. We discussed yesterday afternoon in regard to the onshore matters. This is really the congruent discussion for offshore matters. Was it not? I think it was actually, but never mind. You brought it up yesterday. It's the The question is going to be, if we take the transmission DMLs, as if we can move on, doesn't really matter, they're very similar generation DMLs. Move on to the next one, transmission DMLs. Next. That's it. Sorry, back one. What I'd just like to have clarified is the relationship of the offshore in principle monitoring plan to the DMLs and to obviously the other plans. We have a dotted line relationship, which it may or may not be specifically relating to the plans where the arrow lands, or it might be relating to the totality of the plans on the lower bar. And I don't think I have any real clarity in the overall need for cross-referencing. Could we talk this one through in a similar way to we went through the onshore matters yesterday? If you would prefer, I think in the interests of speed, we could leave this to a post-hearing action. You could send us a description. Would you think that a better way?
Yeah.
Would you be happy to do that?
Yes, we'd be very happy to do that. We don't have Claire Davis with us, who is the sort of the person who knows the intricacies of the relationships between all the plans, the outline plans and the detailed plans. But we'd certainly be happy to come back to you on this in writing.
Understood. I think if you could just look at the dotted line here, and how does the IPMP in particular relate to the DML conditions in each case? Okay, thank you. Good. Now, I think it would be appropriate at this time to see if there's anything that Historic England would like to add to their written representations. It's an opportunity to have a discussion on the, in particular, the provisions to deliver the archaeological WSI. Over to Mr. Pater.
Thank you. Christopher Pater from Historic England. Thank you very much for this opportunity to have a discussion on this matter. As mentioned previously and as included within our written representation, we were very pleased to see the applicant introducing into each of the relevant DMLs, which, for example, I think for the transmission one is 14.2, which alludes to the use of WSI to inform pre-commencement survey activity. We're very pleased to see that that clause is also included in each of the other DMLs, respectively. I think it's 9.2 and 7.2. Across the schedules between 9 and 13. So with those clauses within the draft DML, it's very important that we have confidence established between all parties in terms of the documentation which will actually be to hand or which would be produced to inform the programme of survey work should consent be obtained, but technically before the commencement of the actual project. And the wording is certainly clear in terms of how it is in recognition of this crucial time period between post-consented consent be obtained and the actual initiation of construction works when all of the survey programmes are commissioned, initiated, and which is the optimum time for including the archaeological objectives. So with the documentation that we've seen as part of this application, then of course there's the outline WSI. So the point of clarity is the extent to which the outline WSI becomes, can I say, material in terms of informing that pre-commencement work. That becomes the WSI, because reading through the documentation, and certainly in terms of what was agreed within our Statement of Common Ground, there does seem to be an acknowledgement that a WSI would be produced for that phase, which would be helpful because there are certain elements of the WSI as presently included in the application that could be amended. For example, it doesn't reference that element to 14.2, 9.2 and 7.2 about the pre-commencement element of works. So we would really request clarification, but also in terms of what formal sign-off may be required from our good colleagues at the Marine Management Organisation, the MMO. And I hope you don't mind if I pick up on a point which you just made in your remarks earlier, a moment ago, regarding the in-principle monitoring plan, because we have seen that there is a November revision to the in-principle monitoring plan, which seems to include detail which I'm afraid sort of confuses matters somewhat in terms of if a particular WSI would be used for that pre-commencement phase or if it will be the outline. I'm sure it's an element of wording that can be clarified, but it's obvious that things seem to be going out of synchronization in terms of what we'd expect to see delivered to inform this crucial element of the project should consent be obtained. Thank you.
Thank you. Mr. Hatton, there's a lot to take in there. Is the applicant wanting to make a response right now?
Yes, we're happy to make a response. I'll ask my colleague Victoria Redmond to respond.
Victoria Redmond on behalf of the applicant. I think our understanding is really set out in the condition. So if I can turn to the condition, it says that pre-commencement surveys and archaeological investigations and pre-commencement material operations involving intrusive seabed works must only take place in accordance with a specific written scheme of investigation. And in that sense, I think it would be a separate plan effectively put together at that time, which is itself in accordance with the details set out in the outline offshore written scheme of investigation. So there would be a separate plan, but it would accord with the relevant principles in the outline offshore written scheme of investigation. So I think it's fairly clearly set out in that condition, and I think that we touched on some of the pre-commencement plans yesterday and how they would work, and they're drafted in the same way, essentially, that you would have a separate plan, but which would draw on the relevant aspects in the outline plan for those pre-commencement works. So it's very similar between the offshore and the onshore.
I think we should just, whilst we have MMO here, Mr. Salter, you were alluded to, obviously, in the end, this is going to be an MMO sign-off. Is there anything you want to add at this stage? I suspect that there will be plenty of opportunity in the written process.
Nick Salter for the MCA. The only comments I have will be addressed within the DML conditions that a hydrographic survey is undertaken post installation.
Mr. Pater, I think just to ask you if what you heard needs further clarification. I mean, you have written a comprehensive point in your REP 3, in your deadline 3 submission, and that will no doubt be responded to in due course. Is there anything further for today?
Thank you. Christopher Pater from Historical. Yes, certainly the wording of the 14.2 as read by the representative on behalf of the applicant is certainly very clear in that regard. And what it would be our intention is to make a submission, certainly in reference to how we see clarity provided in any further amendment to the in-principle monitoring plan, as that encompasses archaeological matters. That would be our intention following this hearing. May I also add, if we're prepared to sort of close discussion on this particular item, that I did note on the agenda that further on under 6A3 there is reference to archaeological exclusion zones, AEZs and A2 anomalies, in reference to particularly important natural habitat types. I don't know if you want to question me particularly on that or if it's for other parties.
Are you intending to stay around?
If you would like me to, then I am available.
I think it would be more appropriate if we picked that up as part of the benthic ecology.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you very much. Another one. Yes, MMO.
Ellie Noble, MMO. I just wanted to pick up the query from Historic England that the condition does seem to allow for different WSIs at different times. However, if there is an element of where it's not entirely clear at what point things get signed off, then potentially one thing that we could pick up would be further text in the outline WSI to make it very clear to everybody in one document how all those things fit together.
Yes, thank you. Could the applicant note that? I think this is a very useful guide, and again, it's congruent with what we were talking about yesterday.
Victoria Redman on behalf of the applicant. Yes, thank you. That's been noticed, and we're very happy to liaise further with both the MMO and Historic England on the wording of the outline written scheme of investigation and also the IPMP.
And thank you. It does prompt me, actually, one of the things that we might have said at the beginning of the hearing is often our peripheral vision isn't as good as it should be. If you want to chip in and you put your table around vertically, and then one of my colleagues can nudge me. I think we'll move on now to item four. To item three, the shipping and navigation. Could we have at 569, the navigation risk assessment, figure 22.1 up on the screen. Good.
So perhaps I could just say we've been joined on the front bench by Sam Westwood, who's a principal risk analyst with Anatech, who will deal with the issue of both shipping and navigation and layout of turbines and safety.
Thank you. I would very much like to understand more about the northwest corner of the array. And the figure that I've asked to be put up here is an interesting one because it shows the deviation of shipping routes around the site. And in particular on that northwest corner, I'd like to understand, I think, first, what are the constraints to navigation in this piece of water? We have, in particular, the Shawn Field in fairly close proximity. But I haven't picked up an illustration, an exhibit within the NRA, which shows just how close it is. Could you perhaps talk us through this in the context of what kind of shipping activity we are seeing in this particular piece of sea space?
Sam Westwood for the applicant. So the figure on the screen is a visual representation of where you might see.
Can I just break it?
Yeah.
Is it possible to blow it up a bit? It's difficult for us to see, and I'm pretty sure it's difficult for people at the back to see. Thank you.
So the figure on the screen at the moment is a visual representation of where you might see radar interference. So it does need to be considered in relation to the text that's within the navigational risk assessment surrounding this section. But in relation to navigation, particularly in the northwest corner, as you've asked, there are no restrictions outside of statutory safety zones. So once the site is fully operational, vessels will be able to navigate freely as an open sea area.
Thank you. Could you perhaps guide us as to the superstructure of the Shawn Field that is in that area? Is there any document that we have within the ES which gives us some indication of what the constriction on sea space, if at all there is, should be in this location? I have only the very large scale charts which show the infrastructure, and I have no idea how far away from the red line boundary that is.
Sam Westwood for the applicant. We have prepared another figure, if you'd like to, if I could ask Ellie to put that up on the screen. I think the important thing to note is because there are no restrictions, so out with the statutory safety zones that will either be in place around the turbines during construction or major maintenance or around the safety zone around the Shawn platform, which is a bridge link platform, so it's two platforms in very close proximity. There are no restrictions on navigation. So we did quite a bit of consultation during the navigational risk assessment process where we spoke to regular operators in this area, and no one has raised any concerns with regards to the proximity of Shawn to the array area.
Thank you very much. Now that's helpful. And let me just ask MCA if there are any further questions. It may well have come up in the consultations that you've had already, but if you have anything to add here.
Nick Salter from the MCA. No, thanks, Mr. Bradley. We don't have any further concerns.
Very good. Thank you.
That's what we wanted.
Yeah. Let me just...
Just make sure they're submitting it. It's an examination.
Will you be submitting this illustration into the examination?
Sam Westwood for the applicant, yes, we'll be submitting that illustration.
Thank you.
And when we don't specify a deadline, it is deadline four we're anticipating, unless there's a very good reason why you can't meet deadline four, and no doubt you'll tell us, but just let's assume that everything and that goes throughout is a deadline four submission, please.
I think this would simply come in as part of our summary of oral submissions.
Yes, certainly in this case, but as the day goes on, then we'll assume it's deadline four, unless there's a good reason why it wouldn't be.
Now, just to conclude the shipping and navigation section, on Roman numeral two, we'd like to understand a little bit more about the issue of lines of orientation of the array. At deadline two, the MCA requested that every endeavour should be made by the applicant to accommodate two lines of orientation. I'd like to understand more of what the implications are if that is not possible or that's not provided. Let me ask, perhaps, if I may, Mr. Salter, to make comments on this to start with.
Nick Salter for the MCA. The issue around lines of orientation are twofold for the MCA. Firstly, for surface navigation, and secondly, for search and rescue purposes. So, the offshore wind farms are not closed to vessels once they've been constructed. Vessels are allowed to sail through.
Could you speak closer to the microphone?
Sorry, apologies. Offshore renewables energy installations are not closed to vessels. Vessels may sail through wind farms if they so wish. So the MCA has to consider the risks to mariners. We know that vessels do go in, recreation vessels, fishing vessels, the operations vessels. So our preferred guidance is that they are aligned in straight rows, consistent lines of orientation. Multiple lines of orientation just allows more options for mariners and for search and rescue helicopters, not forgetting that MCA has statutory obligations to provide a search and rescue service in the UK search and rescue region. It provides more options for transiting through wind farms for search and rescue helicopters to conduct searches. And that is our guidance, is that multiple lines of orientation provide the least risk to mariners and search and rescue operations.
Thank you. The applicant's team, is it correct that the risk assessment has been carried out on the basis of a single line of orientation?
Sam Westwood for the applicant. Yes, that's correct. The navigational risk assessment and the accompanying chapter has considered a single line of orientation.
Thank you. Could I ask then for a comment on how you are considering a response to the MCA's request for you mentioned there's multiple lines of orientation, but is it correct that you're really expecting or hoping to achieve two lines of orientation?
Nick Salter, MCA, that is our hope, yes.
Yeah. So could I ask you to respond to that?
Sam Westwood for the applicant. We've been working with the MCA and Trinity House for a number of years, both as this project and the sister project, Northup Vanguard, on the development of the development principles, which are submitted as part of the application. Those development principles are to assist both ourselves, the MCA and Trinity House, and anyone else that wishes to comment on the layout post-consent, because obviously at this point we're not able to say what our layout will look like at that point, in order to be able to manage risks within the site. And if you look at those principles, a lot of them are designed around internal navigation and search and rescue access. So we very much understand that the MCA have a preference for two lines of orientation as a minimum, as stated in MGN 543, the company guidance. And we are very much committed to ensuring that search and rescue access can continue and safe navigation can continue. But as part of that post-consent submission, should we decide to develop a single line of orientation for many varying reasons, it could be geotechnical reasons, it could be turbine type reasoning, we will submit a safety justification to support that layout to ensure that it meets both our and the MCA's requirements, and most importantly, that the site is safe.
So we have a situation.
Can I just ask for clarification there? Are you saying that you will support two lines of orientation unless, for as you said, for the reasons you explain, it needs to be one?
Sam Westwood for the applicant. I think it's best to say at the moment there are no final decisions on layouts, but what we've done in order to ensure that the layout meets the MCA requirements post-consent is put these development principles in place, and they work with either a single line of orientation or multiple lines of orientation. So it would all would depend on what we decide at that point.
And that would be in discussion with MCA.
Sam Westwood for the applicant. So if we decide to develop a layout with a single line of orientation, what we've agreed with the MCA post-consent is that we will submit a safety justification to support that single line of orientation.
Could I ask if that safety justification might include additional mitigation? Because it comes back again to the point that you have a risk assessment, which is part of the application, and then you have, I think, implied but not specifically said that you're basing this on a worst case. Let me try to understand whether this is, let's call it a an ambiguity which has to remain, or whether there's any clarity that can be achieved before the end of examination.
Sam Westwood for the applicant. I think an ambiguity that has to remain isn't quite what either party is intending. I think what the MCA's position is, and Nick will be able to jump in and correct me on this if he doesn't agree, but until the MCA and the other statutory stakeholders see that final layout, they do not want to commit to the safety case that's put forward. So the navigational risk assessment very much makes the case that the single line of orientation assessed within the application is safe and within acceptable parameters, but it is based on turbines being in particular positions, particular size of turbines. Until we actually see where those turbines are and what size they are, how many are, what the minimum spacing is, both parties are content to reserve judgment until post-consent under the condition 14 that's within the license.
Mr. Salter?
Nick Salter, MCA. Yes, I agree with Mrs. Westwood's response there. This is a normal practice for layout designs to be discussed post-consent.
Okay, thank you. I think at that point in that case...
I wonder if the MCA could provide a little bit of context to this. So, in relation to other offshore wind farms, is it usual to have a single line or a two-line orientation as a generalisation? And then a question, if I may, to follow up to the applicant. Why would the applicant not proceed on ensuring two lines unless there was a good reason to do otherwise? I'm not quite understanding that specific point, but if I might ask the MCA first, please.
Nick Salter, MCA. Up until the development of round three wind farms, I think nearly all wind farms have been designed in a grid format, and there was hasn't been much need to discuss layouts up until that point. It was only with the development of larger turbines and further offshore that there is an increased risk to search and rescue and providing a search and rescue service within those wind farms. The need is to discuss layouts with applicants has come forward. Due to the size of the turbines, it's quite possible that helicopters will be flying underneath the height of the turbines. Therefore, there is a need for them to be in straight lines. And then the multiple lines of orientation came in because it provides more options to provide that service. And the risk to search and rescue helicopters aligns fairly well with them transiting through in a surface vessel.
And in your experience, are you confident that the round three offshore wind farms that are coming forward are approaching the challenge with that understanding that one line of orientation is not desirable, but more than one line is? Is that your experience?
Nick Salter, MCA. Our experience is that the MCA and other navigation stakeholders prefer two lines of orientation or at least two. It has been the developers who, in general, have approached us and requested one line of orientation. This is generally my understanding is that to increase energy capture. And each layout design is discussed on a case-by-case basis. There have been round three wind farms with multiple lines. There have been a few round three wind farms with single lines.
Thank you. And then if I might turn to the applicant, please.
Sam Westwood for the applicant. So the question of layouts is a complicated question and has been a question that's been developing as the size and distance offshore of wind farms has increased. I think there's two parts to this question. The first part is about surface navigation and internal navigation. And as Ms. Salter said, it's very much on a case-by-case basis. So what's suitable for a wind farm offshore may not be suitable for a wind farm near shore or within estuary limits, etc. For the case for Norfolk Boreas, traffic navigating internally within the wind farm is expected to be limited. There is no reason for commercial vessels to navigate through, i.e. no cost time saving. Recreational traffic due to the distance offshore is limited. And fishing activity, it is engaged in fishing. Again, it's not vessels that are in transit. What we have been seeing from extensive research we've done through AIS and radar surveys over many years, as you can imagine, as part of my job, is that users actually navigate through wind farms in straight lines, but that does not necessarily mean that they stay within rows and columns, and that's two clear, distinct points. Do they navigate within a row or a column, or do they navigate in straight lines? And yes, they do navigate in straight lines, just the same as they do in open sea area between two waypoints. As round three has developed, spacing has got bigger, and therefore navigating internally has got easier. You can set your waypoints anywhere. You can go through in a straight line. You can alter course within the array. So from a surface navigation perspective, we're very much comfortable that it is safe, regardless of what the internal ray layout is. And in slight disagreement to what Mr. Salter is saying, I would say that we are hearing that from users themselves as well. The reason that we are committing to working with the MCA on a single line of orientation is very much related to search and rescue aircraft. And as a minimum, in order to be able to facilitate that access, we are required to have one line of orientation. And that's very much what we're focused around.
That sounds slightly at odds. You're talking about a single line of orientation, but I'm hearing from the MCA that there are many lines of orientation. So going back to the nub of the question, why would you not proceed with two lines of orientation? Why would your default position be one? That's really what I'm trying to drive to.
Sam Westwood for the applicant. I think our default position at this point is that we have no layout, but what we are committed to working to is as a minimum having one line of orientation that we do consider to be safe.
Okay, and can you just, and I'm sure my colleagues know this, can you just remind me where this level of detail would be secured in the draft development consent order or associated documentation?
Victoria Redmond, on behalf of the applicant. There is a condition in the DML, it's condition 14.1A, and that sets out that the design plan has to be agreed in writing with the MMO in consultation with Trinity House and the MCA, and it has to be in accordance with the with the development principles, which are also a certified document.
And the development principles are quiet on this, on the orientation, or they refer to one?
Sam Westwood for the applicant. It states the wording that is contained within MGN 543, which a minimum of one line of orientation. Beg your pardon, the MGN 543 says the developers should aim for two lines of orientation, but if there is one line of orientation, we should submit a safety justification to support that.
Okay, understand. MCA, did you want to make any further comments on this?
Nick Salter, MCA. I don't have any further comments, I don't think. Everything Mrs. Westwood has said is contained within the MGN. We do, we are willing to look at safety justification, but I'll just make clear that the submission of a safety justification doesn't automatically guarantee agreement.
Let's move on now, if we may, to fishing. Now, as NFFO are not present, I think we may find that we can cut this relatively short, but I do want to let Eastern IFCA have an opportunity to speak if they wish. Point one is, this is regarding a somewhat difficult subject of the whether the magnitude of effects on fisheries should be based on the cumulative impact assessment of past losses or not. Is this something that Eastern IFCA has a position on?
Elise Quinn, Eastern IFCA. To be honest, in all honesty, it's not something we've considered in detail in advance, but it certainly seems interesting. I'd say there's an importance behind assessing past losses and restrictions to access, especially over the last 10 years or so. We definitely kind of defer to fisheries representatives on it, so the NFFO and other associations, but we'd be happy to probably provide something in writing once we've looked at it in more detail, if that's helpful.
Thank you. This is essentially a matter raised by NFFO's Deadline 2 representation 076, Rep 2076. I think the best way forward on this is firstly to just ask the applicant what prospects you consider there is of reaching common ground with NFFO on this in the relatively near future. And secondly, I think we can perhaps leave it to your written response to that representation.
So if I could ask Sarah Zubanova, who's joined the front bench, to respond on that one as necessary. Thank you.
Sarah Zubanova on behalf of the applicant. With regards to the progress on the Statement of Common Grounds, just to note that consultation with NFFO and VSNET is ongoing, and we will try to make progress on some of the issues which are still outstanding. In relation to this specific issue to do with the need of including existing projects and activities in the cumulative assessment, I think we are quite comfortable with our position and the rationale behind it.
If I understand it correctly, your position at deadline three was that including existing projects would represent double counting. Mm-hmm. Is that correct?
Sarah Schubano, on behalf of the applicant, yes, that's correct.
I think that we can make no further progress without NFO here. We'll see how they respond in your further discussions on common ground. Is that satisfactory, Mr. Hatton?
Yes, indeed. And we can respond as necessary in our summary of oral submissions as well.
Yes, Mr. Braithwaite has suggested that I, for purposes of clarity, accept your kind offer to make a submission. Thank you. Let's move on then to point two. I wanted to just give the opportunity here to ask Eastern Ithaca. It's not, I suspect, something that is your area, but it's an opportunity to ask if there's anything that you'd like to say on the fisheries coexistence and liaison plan in regard to risk to fishing vessels. It's an issue which has been raised in written representations, but I think that we may find that we can't make very much progress today.
Elise Quinn, Eastern Ithaca. Yeah, absolutely. So our submission for deadline two was very much in response to KAISTER and Inshore Fishermen's Association's comments with regards to previous experience of wind farm vessels operating outside of the remit of what they've said they will, and that causing a risk to safety and navigation. And we were just kind of confirming that's something we hear from a lot of stakeholders all over the coast, but no real further information. And generally, we're very happy with what's in the plans. It's just making sure those are taken forward at the construction operational phases and enforced.
Thank you. We'll follow this up with a written question. And I think that this is probably a good opportunity to conclude, unless there's anything further that the applicant would like to say on that matter.
Again, I'll ask Sarah Zubanova if there are any comments to wish to add.
Sarah Shubanova on behalf of the applicant. In relation to the fisheries liaison and coexisting plan, I think it is important to clarify that what was submitted at as part of application is an outline plan, and this will be refined when we have more information about construction, etc., and will be submitted to the MMO for approval. And there's a condition to ensure this happens this way. I think it's also important to note that in the current outline plan, there is consideration of a number of measures which are of relevance to help to minimize interactions between fishing vessels and project vessels. And I just have an outline of some of the things that we have included so far in the outline plan, but includes the reference to the development of a code of good practice for contracted vessels, the development of a fisheries guidance document to reduce interaction with fishing activity and provide response procedures, the provision of procedures for safe recovery of lost or snagged fishing gear, as well as the development of procedures for claims of loss or damage of fishing gear. So from this point of view, I think we are quite confident that the information included in the outline plan so far takes consideration of this potential issue.
Thank you. I think just for the purposes of completeness, is there anything that MMO would like to add?
Ellie Noble, MMO. I'm not aware of any specific concerns regarding that plan. I think it would just be making sure that the right people are consulted when it comes to the detail.
Thank you very much. I'll hand back to Mr. Braithwaite now. Take a few
words. Yep. Thank you very much. Now we can move on to item six. And just before we start on marine
item five. Before we start on marine mammals, I would just like to say that we are aware that Natural England have submitted a late submission, which we will be publishing at deadline four. So in effect, no one has seen it, including ourselves, but please be at liberty to discuss whatever is in that document during the following sections.
Okay. Chris McMullen, Natural England. Yes, thank you. We'll be happy to do that.
All right. Thank you. So 5A, noise monitoring. Now, again, just as introduction to this item, the applicant doesn't consider it necessary to include a maximum hammer energy for pin piles within the DCO. Now, we have had representations from MMO, Natural England, and Whale and Dolphin Conservation, who are all concerned that maximum hammer energies should be used, a requirement. And I think before asking the regulators, if I could just ask the applicant, has there been any additional movement on this point, or are you still resisting including maximum hammer energy?
Victoria Redman, on behalf of the applicant, we have discussed this further with the MMO, and we have agreed to include this in the condition.
So the MMO is now content?
I hope so.
Right. Could I then ask Natural England, do you have any outstanding issues?
Sorry, Alan Gibson, Natural England. We're content with the updated license condition.
Sorry, I know you're having trouble with the microphones, but could you repeat that closer to the microphone?
Alan Gibson, Natural England, we are content with the updated license condition.
Thank you. Now, unfortunately, we can't check with WDC, but WDC have additional concerns about piling and are actually strongly recommending that monopiles or pin pile foundations are not used. I think as WDC are not present, it's probably not helpful to progress this, because I'm sure you have already responded to their Rep 2 submission, and I think this may form the basis of a second written question.
If it's helpful, sir, I could ask Jen Learmonth, who's joined the front bench, just to make a brief comment on it, but I'm in your hands on that.
Well, I think if you could just make a brief comment, you don't have to go through all of the issues, but if you could just make a brief comment, that would be helpful.
Jennifer Learmonth on behalf of the applicant. Within the envelope of design for the project, a number of foundation types and installation methods are being considered, and of these, impact piling has been assessed as a worst-case scenario, so that all impacts for other methods and techniques would come within that overall envelope for impact piling.
Okay, and again, just for my own clarity, so basically, you're looking at the worst case. You're not saying that gravity foundations or other foundations will not be used, but the worst case is piling.
Jennifer Learmonth on behalf of the applicant. Yes, that's correct.
Yeah, right. Thank you for that. In that case, we can move on to point two. Now, again, this was mentioned in the Secretary of State's letter on Vanguard, where where the Secretary at Norfolk Vanguard, that there was reference to blue piling, vibro piling, Blue Hammers and vibro piling, which has not been referenced for Barais. So again, I'd just like to check with the applicant if there is any intention of introducing or considering alternative piling technologies, as was discussed at Vanguard.
Again, if I can refer this to Jen Learmonth, please.
Jennifer Learmonth, on behalf of the applicant. Yes, other piling installation methods are being considered. The Blue Hammer wasn't included specifically as part of the Boreas, as an example in the Boreas application, because at that time it wasn't commercially available. However, since then there has been some developments, and I think that is now undergoing further research. But again, it's still not commercially available, so it's just an example of a technique that could be used, as is vibropiling. But both of these need further information about what the underwater noise implications could be and suitability for large offshore wind farms. So we're not ruling in or out any of these techniques, and if they've not been listed, it doesn't mean to say they won't be considered in due course. However, I think it's important to note that the condition refers to piled foundations, not just impact piled foundations. So these techniques or any other similar techniques that could come or be developed between now and construction would be covered by that condition and what's required under that for further assessment of the impacts or potential impacts of underwater noise and what mitigation could be required for those.
And I presume that you are in discussions with Natural England and the MMO regarding noise. Possible information on noise level associated with these new technologies, as the SOS requested.
Unfortunately, as these are new techniques, there isn't much information currently available. However, as and when further information on these becomes available, and if that is being considered ongoing for the project, then yes, these will be further investigated and assessed.
And finally, will you be proposing to include a similar condition to the condition 14.1F that was considered for Vanguard?
We have discussed this with Natural England and the MMO, and we think the wording is sufficient to cover this and that there's no wording changes required either for Boreas or for Vanguard.
Thank you for that. Can I now check with MMO?
Rebecca Reed, the MMO. Yeah, we think that the current condition covers any additional techniques.
And
Louise Burton, Natural England. I'm swapping my hat at the moment. So I'm a Natural England senior responsible officer for the Norfolk Vanguard project. And I've recently provided some feedback to the applicant for Vanguard, indicating that similarly, we do not want the condition changing because we think it's overly restrictive for the Norfolk Vanguard project. So therefore, we agree completely with the applicant and the MMO for the Boreas project that it's sufficiently restrictive as it currently stands.
Well, thank you very much for that. Very clear response. I don't think we need to discuss that any further. Thank you very much. So moving on to point three. Now, again, to explore whether noise monitoring is necessary for more than just the first few piles. Currently, the applicant is proposing to monitor the first four piles. And again, this is being disputed by WDC and MMO. And the Wildlife Trust, sorry, Natural England, and the Wildlife Trusts. Again, I'd like to actually combine three and four together because they do tend to overlap. So the issues are monitoring for first four piles, is that sufficient? And secondly, is it necessary to monitor the marine mammals themselves rather than just the piling noise? Again, I'd turn to the applicant to see if there has been any advancement on those issues in discussion with the other IPs.
So I think the short point on this is that in the relevant condition, there is a mechanism for a reference up to the MMO for further monitoring where appropriate. But I'll ask Jen Learmonth to expand on that.
Thank you.
Jennifer Learmonth on behalf of the applicant. Yes, this has been discussed and agreed with both Natural England and the MMO that the measurements and monitoring underwater noise from the first four pile types is a minimum requirement to ensure that what's been predicted is with what's actually taking place. We agree that where possible, this could include areas of high resistance, which would give an indication of noise levels from increased hammer energy rather than just the first four easiest sites. But obviously that's could be technical restrictions on what piles are put in first and where. Therefore, we don't think there's any change required to the wording of this condition because it already contains the option for the MMO to require further noise monitoring if required.
Thank you for that. Again, looking across the room, MMO nodding their heads in agreement.
Ellie Noble, MMO, yes. Generally in agreement also that the locations to be monitored are agreed in advance, so there is also that opportunity there to request for specific locations or different or additional locations.
Well, thank you for that. And Natural England.
Alan Gibson, Natural England. I suppose I would note that we would see the points three and four being slightly different. So for point three, we would agree that the first four piles is seen as, well, we would describe it as the minimum requirement. Ideally, we would also like to see the high resistance ones. However, we are not proposing a change to the condition or the actual monitoring, and we do note that there is a possibility of asking for further monitoring. However, with regard to point four, which I think might link back to our request for a condition for marine mammal monitoring, and I think there might be some potentially some confusion here, that the point three is addressing noise monitoring. We've asked for a condition to secure marine mammal monitoring, which is different. So the sort of the reasoning behind that is that we're looking for monitoring to validate the assumptions of the environmental statement and the habitats regulations assessment for the individual project. However, it's also understood that it's up to the applicant to identify the best way to achieve this for the project, and that this could be through a contribution to collaborative or strategic work, and that there are some programs out there for them that they could contribute to, such as ORGIP and other programs which might be appropriate for their platform. And we also note that their in-principle monitoring plan has a commitment to this, which we are satisfied with. So what we're specifically asking for is a condition linking to that commitment, just to ensure that that it is followed through on.
Thank you for that. And the applicant, are you considering that commitment, additional commitment?
Jennifer Learmonth on behalf of the applicant. Yes, it was. We have discussed and agreed with Natural England that a strategic approach to marine mammal monitoring is probably the best way forward, and therefore we're open to collaborative and strategic approaches on how we can contribute to that. We feel that the monitoring requirements can and will be agreed and secured in development of the finalised monitoring plan.
And how is that conditioned?
Dave Tarrant on behalf of the applicant. That is in the in-principle monitoring plan that we will commit to strategic monitoring if required, if that's agreed with the MMO and Natural England. So there is a commitment within the in-principle monitoring plan.
Jennifer Lermonth on behalf of the applicant. This could also be included in the site integrity plan if there's any specific monitoring requirements required in relation to harbour porpoise within the Southern North Sea SEC.
Yes, MMO?
Yes, just to point out that there may well be a need for more discussion about that, that potentially Natural England would need more certainty around how that monitoring is going to be conditioned on the DML, and that we would just recommend or welcome the chance to have a further look at that and another discussion with all the parties.
Yes, so I'm conscious that at deadline four we've asked for an updated draft development consent order in track changes, and we're talking today a little bit about additional conditions for the DMLs, and so my question to you would be whether these additional conditions will make it into that revised and updated draft development consent order, which is due in about a week's time. What I'm not clear about from the discussions is how much progress has been made behind the scenes and as to how that might be reflected in the updated draft development consent order.
Victoria Redman on behalf of the applicant. I think we have been progressing discussions, and I think where agreement has been reached already or can be reached before we submit the DCO, then it will be included. I think this is one, as Ms. Noble said, that may need a bit more further discussion, so the extent to which it can get into the DCO, I'm not sure, but we'll certainly do our best.
And so as we're going through today, if additional conditions or refinements to existing drafting are proposed, it would be helpful if you could indicate whether we would see this at deadline four or if that's for some later date. And the reason I'm asking that is it may have a bearing on our further written questions as to what we're asking for and what we're expecting to see.
Thank you. WDC are in their rep 2112, when they're talking on impact monitoring, they are requiring mammal monitoring both during construction and post-construction. Now, is that something which Natural England would support?
Alan Gibson, Natural England. I don't think we would necessarily fully support that. We would say that during construction, the mammals are unlikely to be there as there'd be sufficient noise disturbing them away from the area.
Yeah, I think WDC's concerns are the additional shipping and during operation, but that's for them to explain. Moving on to the more strategic point, the Wildlife Trusts, and I know this is much wider than this examination, but the Wildlife Trust advocates the introduction of a conditioned underwater noise fund whereby all offshore wind farm developments should contribute funding and participate in the delivery of strategic monitoring. Again, that's in the Rep 2098. Just wondering if that is something which the applicant would support.
Again, I'll ask Jen Lermonth to respond on this.
Thank you.
Jennifer Lermonth on behalf of the applicant. If such measures were put in place, then we'd be willing to support that. But as yet, it's just proposed by the Wildlife Trust, and we're not sure how much backing that has elsewhere. But if it does come to fruition, we would be supportive of such schemes if required.
Okay. Thank you for that. Yeah, I think that clarifies points three and four. And then moving on to five, identify whether there are any construction techniques other than panning under consideration that could result in noise impacts. I mean,
the whole discussion at the moment has obviously been on piling in the foundations, but are there any other construction techniques that would have an impact on marine noise?
Jennifer Lermith on behalf of the applicant. Within the EES and HRE, we did underwater noise modelling for a range of different construction activities that could be associated not just with piling. This includes dredging, cable laying, rock placement, trenching and vessel noise, a lot of which could be applicable to other installation techniques. But I think it's clear that we've already said the condition covers piling and that piling has been assessed as the worst case.
Yeah, thank you for that. But I'd just like to check with MMO and NE if you have any comments, or are you content that obviously piling is the worst case, but do you have any concerns about other construction noise, including vessels, on...
Alan Gibson, Natural England. We are content and we have no concerns regarding the other noisy activities.
And MMO?
Rebecca Reed, the MMO. Yeah, we are also content and have no concerns of the other activities.
Okay, thank you very much. I think that gives a natural break for coffee. Can I suggest that we break now and reconvene at 11:45? Thank you very much.